Views expressed on this program are those of the hosts, guests, and callers, and are not necessarily those of this station, its management, or other advertisers. You're listening to Transformation Talk Radio.
This show's audio was via a Skype call.
Welcome to Knowledge Book Radio with Marge Potasek. Marge was searching for the purpose of her life and the truth that would tie everything together to make sense of what was taught and what was happening on our planet, the fire that was creating all the smoke. Through many experiences, she was finally led to the Knowledge Book that provided all the answers. Marge is now talking about this gift to humanity on Knowledge Book Radio, so all can be united in peace, love, and harmony. This live call-in show at 1-800-930-2819 is amazing. So get ready to hear about the Knowledge Book. Here's your host, Marge Potasek.
Hello, everyone. I'm Marge Potasek, and you are listening to the Knowledge Book Radio with Marge Potasek on Transformation Talk Radio. For the next hour, we will continue to cover some of the topics from the Knowledge Book or some of the topics that support the information or explain the information in the Knowledge Book. And this week, we are going to talk about rocks, art, and evolution. How are these related? But before we go on and actually delve into the topic, just want to remind you that our website is www.usa.theknowledgebook.net. The Turkish website for the World Brotherhood Union is www.dkb-mevlana.org.tr. My contact information is cell phone 973-787-7035. And my email address is mmjp99@gmail.com. That's marymaryjohnpeter99@gmail.com. So these are the two contact points for sending us any kind of questions that you have based on today's topic that we're covering, any previous show topics that we've covered, or any questions that you may have had while reading the Knowledge Book. And we also accept any kinds of topics that you may have that you would like to have delved into and researched and presented on this show. So, the Knowledge Book talks about art and the art codes being the highest level of the creative mechanism of each dimension. And the history of art and how that art reflects man's evolution and consciousness was actually the original topic for this segment that I plan to present. And when I actually looked at that topic, that became like fitting Mount Everest into a thimble. And that topic was way too big and vast to be able to present it and kind of delve at least a little bit into it on this show. The span of the history of art actually ranges, based on some current scientific estimates, from about 30,000 BC to the present. So initially, in the early stages of our evolution, someone noticed, probably by cutting themselves, that some rocks have very sharp edges when split or chipped. So this particular person had the idea that this now sharp rock could be useful. So this individual, or maybe another individual that looked at what had happened to the first individual, that they had cut themselves with this sharp rock, and this was probably the first artist or engineer, started to find ways to hit rocks with other rocks and produce tools that allowed them to kill prey, sew clothes, chop wood, etc. And then others, just like the present, Other budding engineers or artists improved and fine-tuned this new technology and designed better tools and methods to use them. So if anyone has done any kind of lookup or gone to a museum, they had an, or maybe you went just playing around in a park somewhere or near a mountain somewhere or somewhere near a lake or river, and you found maybe an arrowhead, maybe you found a cutting tool, maybe you found something that looked akin to, maybe that could be used to make holes in leather or something else. So there are various kinds of rocks that are found in museums and outdoors by people that are examples of the kinds of tools and kinds of rock chipping that the original people actually used as the original tools. Okay, so again, some other early humans noticed that when certain plants or colorful ground-up rocks left permanent stains on the rocks, and they also saw that those stains remained intact when they were inside a cave and far away from the eroding effects of sun, wind, rain, ice, etc. And then maybe it was the same individual, or maybe not, but someone had the idea that they could record their history on the walls of the caves or depict scenes as part of a shamanistic rite that could produce or a productive hunt for some yet unknown reason. So we don't really know how these cave arts came about, but when I'm sure some of you may have seen depictions, or some of you may have been lucky enough to actually go into a cave where this art is on the walls, but you'll have representations maybe of handprints, maybe of animals, maybe of what looks like early cows or bison or the mammoths. But you will see representations of animals and maybe processes that are being followed by art, by artists at that time. And maybe they realized, and maybe they saw, that when they depicted something and thought about that depiction of maybe a successful hunt, maybe that idea that's being depicted actually produced the consciousness and the other humans who were looking at it and were inspired by it to actually have a successful hunt, okay? So maybe that's part of the reason why those cave paintings are there. Now, the most widely known and extensive cave paintings are those found in Lascaux in southern France. And these are estimated to have been produced around 15,000 BC during the Stone Age. And the Stone Age itself spanned from about 30,000 BC to about 2500 BC. And in this period, it was mainly the rocks that were manipulated and used to form tools and as canvases, meaning the rock itself was not important, but what we can do with the rock on paint on the rock was important. Then from about 3500 BC to 539 BC, that's when the Mesopotamian era came in. And this was the time where Mesopotamia was the, center of culture at that time. And this was when the Sumerians invented writing. And Hammurabi actually wrote his laws. And Abraham instituted monotheism, the belief in a single God. And at this time, there was another innovator, another artist, another engineer. Someone had noticed that a hard instrument could make marks on rocks and had the idea that rocks themselves could be carved to have a possibly more permanent record. So I guess they noticed during the cave time that if someone smudged the drawing or whatever, it had the possibility to be somewhat modified and destroyed. And if the cave kind of collapsed, then went, and no more of the history of that time was preserved. So again, At that time, rocks were used as tools. However, at this time, the rocks were carved to depict gods, to depict warriors, and narration in relief. So this is where rocks themselves and other hard instruments were used to show what the gods looked like. And you'll have pictures, or you'll have carved in stones, entities with wings and entities doing certain things. You'll have depictions of certain entities, one being basically a king-like individual carrying spears, going out to the hunt and vanquishing the beast and coming back with the quarry. And you'll have also depictions of gods that were half animal, half human. So you'll have a depiction of a head attached to a lion's body, but the lion itself would have wings. So these are the ideas of what gods looked like at that time that were depicted in stone. Now, the next stage of development of art was in Egypt, from about 3000 BC to 30 AD. Now, Egypt itself reached a very high level in painting, carving, and sculpture. The art was highly stylized and symbolic, and the focus here was mostly on the afterlife, on religious themes, or pharaoh's historic events. The Egyptians also had formal funerary rituals and made great efforts to ensure the survival of their souls after death by providing tombs, grave goods, offerings, and preserving the bodies and the spirits of the deceased. Funeral processions were carved inside Egyptian tombs, mainly on limestone and sandstone as reliefs. So I don't know if anyone has seen or been to a museum that has Egyptian artifacts, but you'll notice that the faces that are depicted are usually presented from a three-quarter angle, so it's not full face forward or not full profile. It's in between, because apparently that's what they saw as being the best representation of the human in, you know, from a 3D form into a 2D, basically, depiction in stone. And you'll find in those pictures that those humans basically look the same. They had the same length of legs. They had the same length of arms. The positions of those arms and legs were basically stylized in a particular direction and a particular stance. Again, gods were being depicted. Again, pharaohs, the most important people, were depicted with instructions for the afterlife and what to do afterlife. And they also used stones. They preserved the dead. So if you remember the mummies were kept in specific homes. The Egyptian pharaohs had their, you know, pyramids. And when the body was mummified, the dead person's viscera were stored in canopy jars. And these are specific jars, four of them, that sometimes were made of pottery, sometimes of gold, sometimes of bronze, sometimes of precious stone or wood or calcite. And this is where the heart, the lungs, and the viscera were held, because those were the ones would most likely decay inside the body, so that was taken out. Okay, and that's, again, a use of stone where they held the precious parts of the body inside the tomb of the pharaoh. Okay, or the other person that may have been buried, but their tombs would be less elaborate than the pharaoh's. Okay, now if you remember, in terms of having the idealized figure of a human, recently they found what they consider to be the mummified remains of Nefertiti, Queen Nefertiti. And if you remember, there is a famous bust of Nefertiti. And when someone took the skull of Nefertiti as coming from the mummified body of Nefertiti, and they did a reconstruction from the skull of what the face must have looked like, the face itself, as reconstructed based on the skull structure and where the muscles are attached to the skull does not look like Nefertiti in the bust. And you can see very clearly that the bust is an idealized form of what Nefertiti must have looked like on a naturally. Okay. And of course, here, limestone, the most famous use of limestone, are the Great Pyramids of Egypt. And everyone is still mystified by this pyramids of Egypt then, and is still mystified now. And humanity is still debating how the pyramids were constructed, is still discovering new chambers, and still finding yet unknown characteristics. In fact, at the beginning of November in 2017, a new hidden void, at least 100 feet long, was discovered by scientists. The void that they found resembles the dimensions of the Grand Gallery, which is 153 feet long and 26 feet tall corridor that leads to the burial chamber in the Great Pyramid. And at this point, this is now this time, no one knows what is in that space, what it was used for, or even if it's one space or many spaces. So the mystery continues and the hunt is on. And of course, we have seen the view of the Great Pyramids in Nile, on the Nile, and seen the complex and the archaeology being done around it. They're still digging. They're still trying to discover how it all came to be and how it's going. But of course, stone played a very prominent part in the construction and the use of these pyramids. And of course, let's not forget about the research that's still being done about the Great Sphinx. Edgar Cayce had predicted that there was a chamber containing ancient knowledge between its paws. And indeed, a chamber was discovered using ground-penetrating radar. However, we still don't know what's in there because permission has not been given to excavate the chamber by the Egyptian Supreme Council of Antiquities. And of course, the Sphinx is a complete mystery as to why it looks the way it looks, why the face doesn't have a nose, and why it's, you know, facing a specific direction. So, to summarize, throughout Egypt's history, harder stones like granite and basalt were used for temples and tombs. Flint was used to carve softer stones like limestone and sandstone, while copper and bronze tools were used to carve the harder stones. Stones and rocks, as used by the Egyptians, were the building blocks, as well as both the canvas and how what was depicted on that canvas was formed. And the next step in the history of mankind occurred during the Greek and Hellenistic period between 850 BC to 31 BC. This was the time of idealism, of balance, of perfect proportions and architectural orders, like the Doric, the Ionic, and the Corinthian. And if you remember from school, the Doric was the simple, the plain support. The column was plain, and the support at top was also plain. The Ionic, however, the column was more intricately carved. It was convex, and the top had scrolls. And the Corinthian was very elaborate. The columns also had a very specific shape, and the actual top of the column had scrolls, had leaves, had all kinds of designs. It was more elaborate. Okay, so those are the three which you may remember from school and learning about in school. And again, just like the Egyptians, this was the time when the human form was idealized and depicted in perfect proportions, carved mostly from marble. And marble, of course, is a precious stone. And this is what was used to depict the gods and goddesses in Greece. And this is when the Parthenon was built again of limestone, just like the Egyptians, and the columns themselves were built of marble. And this time, this is the first time that marble was used as a support structure in the construction of a building. Now, the Greeks had the idea that the function of sculpture was to honor the gods and goddesses. So the Parthenon that was built was both an homage to Athena and, being, I guess, more pragmatic than we think that they were, it was also used as a state treasury. Apparently, there was a statue of Athena in the temple, in the Parthenon, but it no longer exists. And there is one theory that says that it was destroyed in a fire in the 5th century. There is another theory that says it was looted by a Roman emperor. Well, the statue itself was about 40 feet tall, and it was made of ivory and gold, so I guess it was very lootable. And another theory is that it was destroyed in the 4th Crusade. So, where the Greeks were the idealists and perfectionists, the Romans were the pragmatists. In the period between 500 BC and 476 AD, the practical, logical Romans took a realistic approach and proceeded to use ideas previously discovered to build roads, the Colosseum, the Pantheon, the aqueducts. So the Romans basically borrowed everything from someone else, the ideas from someone else, mainly Greece, and they even borrowed the gods from Greece. But when those gods were taken from Greece and brought to Rome, they just gave them different names. So they became Romanized by being given different names. Now, the Pantheon is the most preserved and influential building in Rome. It was originally built and used as a temple to all the gods. And it was constructed of limestone, marble, brick, with a concrete dome. And even 2,000 years after being built, it is still and has the largest unreinforced concrete dome. It has a diameter of 143 feet, and the other capital and dome, the other dome that is has a similar structure is the Capitol in Washington, D.C., and that has a span of 96 feet. So you can imagine it's about 50 feet difference between the two. And this was done back in the Roman time. So again, the Pantheon still exists, and it has beautiful, the dome is beautifully shaped. And if anyone goes to Rome, it's a good thing to visit there because it's beautiful, and it really, they did a beautiful job in its construction. Now, to give you a little bit of an idea of how it was built, the exterior walls of the Colosseum, okay, that's the Pantheon. Now we're going to talk about the Colosseum. And the Colosseum is not in as great shape as the Pantheon. The Colosseum itself, and this is where the Roman circuses were held, it was constructed of 300 tons of travertine, which is actually limestone, a form of marble. And the travertine, because it is such a high quality, was stripped from the structure. And none of that original travertine covering on the exterior walls remains. And inside, the luxury seats were made of marble. Now, most of what we can see now and what remains of the Colosseum was constructed of tuff. And this tuff is a sedimentary stone composed of compressed volcanic ejecta. So if you remember, when a volcano erupts, part of that eruption, part of the stone that goes into the air, it solidifies in the air, but it has lots of, it's porous. That's where pumice comes from. It's lots of bubbles, air bubbles inside the stone that solidifies. And it's strong, so it can be used in construction, but at the same time, it's light compared to regular stone. So if you have pumice at home, you could put it in water and it'll float on water. So it becomes light, but at the same time holds its shape and it is strong. So most of the upper floors are made with tuff, and these were covered then with tiles. But tough tends to be brittle. And the structure itself was damaged by earthquakes. And that's why a large portion of the Colosseum is no longer standing. And I had the luck to actually drive by the Colosseum. It's a huge structure. It takes a while to go around. Didn't have a chance to go inside. But you can tell the skill and the way things were constructed, and hats went off to the Romans for having built it, that and the Pantheon. And of course, Romans being the pragmatists that they were, they built the aqueducts, which were mostly made of locally quarried stones and cement. And the aqueducts were the ones that provided water for drinking, for sanitation, for farming, and so forth. Now, these aqueducts were a way of getting water from point A to point B by going across valleys, by going through mountains, and being able to bring in water from one place, let's say a lake, and bring it into the cities. So the Romans were really practical. They produced the indoor plumbing. They had street cleaning. They were really wonderful, real engineers. And again, the Romans, like the Greeks and the other civilizations before them, utilized stone in construction and decoration of buildings. But from that point forward, stone continued to be used in construction, with improved arches and domes, and eventually buildings were built using reinforced concrete and steel. So stone, like marble, travertine, polished granite, and others were used for decorative features. In all cases, the stone was carved, shaped, manipulated to create the desired effect. The art of the East, and starting with the Renaissance and up to our current times, art innovations revolved around painting. Stone and rocks were part of the natural landscapes being depicted, or instrumental in building a mood or an idea. If anyone has seen or studied Eastern paintings from the Far East, it tends to be more flat. Not much three-dimensional stuff is going on. And the rocks themselves just provide a backdrop for the clouds, the mists, the trees, the temples, and the rivers that are being depicted. They become part of the scenery, the calm scene that they are creating, the chill and the quiet, calm depiction of the scenery. And also, arts were used to build a mood during the Renaissance and onward, especially onward, where the rocks are boulders upon which a man may be standing. And this man is faced with, and he's looking down into possibly a valley, possibly he's standing on a cliff with mists and clouds in front of him. So this is basically creating an idea, an air of uncertainty, of risk, of fear, of not being able to decide what to do. So rock is then a backdrop for this creation of a mood and a scenario. There were many periods and waves of art styles and subjects being depicted in paintings. Starting from the Middle Ages, the focus again shifted. And this time it went from gods and goddesses and building temples and churches, and it became more human-centered to the point that the stars and planets revolved around the earth with man at its center. Eventually, this focus shifted as scientific discoveries and the Industrial Revolution showed the comparative, in solar system terms, insignificance of the earth and humans. The realistic depictions of nature changed, with the focus being on the human and impressions of what was observed, leading to including the spectator becoming part of the installation of the art. And around the time of the 20th century and coming to the current times, The focus was more on the common, everyday objects. So, from the time of the Renaissance and onward, actually Middle Ages and Renaissance and onwards, again, the shift was to the human, and the humans were depicted in relationship to the saints, in human form. And the styles of art, where the art was removed from the beings who are looking at the art, at around the turn of the century, somehow the viewer was included and became the target, and the art became a means of communication between the artist and the human who was looking at that art. Okay, so it's about that time that all of a sudden, during the early part and latter and mid part of the 20th century, we had all of a sudden pop art, where you've had Campbell's cream of mushroom soup being depicted as an art. You had nine faces in different colors of Marilyn Monroe. Maybe the artist was showing us that Marilyn Monroe was changing in frequency, because if you change a color, then you change the frequency. Each color has a frequency. So maybe this was the different frequencies of Marilyn Monroe at different times of the day or different times of her life. But anyways, somehow it is no longer a presentation of what the artist thinks. It now becomes an interaction between the artist and the viewer as to what possibly this could contain. And the actual depiction of things like pigs, things like chairs, things like anything in the house also became distorted. So you really didn't know what you were looking at, and you had to really think about what you were looking in order to be able to try to understand what the artist was saying. Okay. And where before marble and precious stones were used to depict idealized forms of gods and goddesses and kings and pharaohs, right now, marble and precious stones at the turn of the century and towards the middle part of the 20th century, marble and precious stones were used to carve purses. And that purse could be an orange purse made from calcite marble. There is a green little girl's toddler's dress that was carved from green onyx. There is a robe, a bathrobe, a checkered bathrobe. So if you remember, there are bathrooms that are tiled with four tiles around and a black one in the center. So this is a bathrobe that's made from black and white marble. And it's a bathrobe, literally a black bathrobe. And then, of course, there is another use of marble and silver. And in this case, the marble and silver were carved to form beach slippers. Okay, so we're going from depicting gods and goddesses to very common everyday object that we use in everyday use. Now, currently, at this time, in the 21st century, the beginning of the 21st century, we have produced special paints for rocks. And there is rock art that is being produced. Some rocks are painted, no matter what shape of the rock. They're usually smaller pieces of rock. Some of them are painted to look like animals. Some of them are painted to look like amphibians. But they're naturalistic forms. However, there are some rocks that are painted with abstract forms, and still others reflect the universe, meaning on that rock, you'll have depictions of a certain portion of the sky or certain star configurations, or you'll have abstract patterns formed on rocks, either designs or mandalas, something. And then they have, of course, fun rocks, very fun rocks, where you'll have huge eyes or one eye and depicting monsters maybe from movies that were popular or are popular at the time. But somehow, in 2012, a 340-ton boulder, an unchanged, unsculpted, undecorated boulder was installed at the Los Angeles County Museum of Art. The boulder sits on top of a concrete trench through which visitors may walk. The art community was in an uproar, and many of them are still in an uproar, with many being very highly critical of the exhibit. And we've come full circle. We're back at the rock. However, in this case, it is not the backdrop. It is the focus, the center of attention. At each step of humanity's artistic development, as we've traveled through time, there was someone who had an idea and the will to bring that idea into fruition. We've only touched the tip of the iceberg. Where do these ideas come from? I'm sure many have gone through difficult problems that needed to be solved, gone through a period of chaos and confusion. And then, as if by magic, an idea comes into our head, a perfect solution to the problem or chaos we were facing. Authors, poets, artists often characterize this phenomenon as being inspired or breathing in what was already there and waiting for them to pick it from the ether. The knowledge book explains that each art has 9 layers, whether that's cooking, gardening, sewing, sports, playing a musical instrument, math, etc. Every artist, like everyone else, receives energies and frequencies from the 10th dimension, what is known as the mechanism of influences. Each artist and human receives these energies in direct proportion to their evolution and consciousness. The influences are then translated by the brain into ideas that are presented to society, parallel to the social consciousness level, but at the same time, they bring ideas and concepts ahead of the times they are living in. They are always a step or more ahead of the generally accepted norm. This happens during the training and education portion of our evolution, what the knowledge book calls level 1 through 7 of the layers of art. According to the knowledge book, corroborated by art history, every step of the evolution of humanity and the art forms it produced over its trip up the evolutionary path is through the 9 layers of art. Initially, the inspiration came from nature, then from the clouds and the sky, then from the rainbow and stars, and then from spirits and space. At the first 7 layers, the educating and training layers, we literally breathe in, take in the influences from the mechanism of influences. But once we reach the 8th and 9th layer, we integrate ourselves with our essence power, and we are released from the mechanism of influences. We become genuine artists that merged with their creative power and that exhibit their own essence consciousness. At this stage, we can receive reflections from beings in different dimensions by a program called Reflection of Human to Human. As we go up the evolution ladder, following the guidelines given in the knowledge book, we will arrive at a level where we will see the Creator in everything we see. We will be able and be at the level to love and respect the created because of the Creator. We will be able to truly honor the rock, the strong, patient, supporting, friendship-building, protecting, beautifying rock. We will ask forgiveness from it because we tripped on it or walked on it, instead of cursing it as we casually currently do. We will appreciate and respect the truly wonderful creation that has been serving us over thousands of years in so many ways. Maybe the artists who depicted cans, pocketbooks, dresses, pigs, etc., were showing us that all is perfect, introducing us to the law of acceptance. In the law of acceptance, everything is positive. Maybe humanity is getting close to succeeding in its evolution, since an artist, usually a step ahead of the times, is now showing us that the rock does not need adornment. It is perfect as it is. And now it looks like it's a good time for a break. And you've been listening to the Knowledge Book Radio with Marge Potasek. And it's time to remind everyone once again that our website is www.theknowledgebook.net. The telephone number for questions and topics is 973-787-7035. And when we come back, we will continue with the topic of rocks, art, and evolution. How are these related? Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Integrate spirituality into your everyday lives on Universe Soul Heart Radio. Tune in each month on Transformation Talk Radio as Kathleen Johnson explores the concept of sensible spirituality, keeping you grounded, connected, and centered on the path to wholeness. Kathleen has dedicated her life to facilitating holistic healing and wholeness in others. Listen to Universe Soul Heart Radio and learn how to flourish, grow, and impact all we do on planet Earth. For more information, go to universesoulheart.net.
Stay juicy. Tune in to Your Juicy Love with me, Una Drake, co-hosting monthly with Dr. Pat, and every second Monday at 12 p.m. on Transformation Talk Radio. My show, Your Juicy Love, helps you find the dynamic, life-affirming love you've always wanted. Transform your relationships and bring peace, joy, and juicy, juicy love to planet Earth. For more information, visit unadrake.com.
Amber Teal, founder of The Healthy Edge, is bringing you the hit show Healthy Edge Radio, living with power, passion, and purpose. Amber provides the support and tools necessary for you to finally release the weight and emotions that are hidden beneath the weight. Tune in each month on Transformation Talk Radio. For more information on how you can take the next step with Amber, visit GetTheHealthyEdge.com.
Are you stuck in unhealthy habits, toxic relationships, or low self-esteem? Do you crave a life of inspiration, love, self-acceptance, and fun? Sounds like you're on the verge. On the verge to your next big thing. Join Laura Richer, host of On the Verge Radio, helping you use your breakdown for a breakthrough, overcome life's greatest challenges, and live the life you want and deserve. Tune in each month on Transformation Talk Radio or visit SeattleHealingHypnosis.com for more information.
Wow. Hey, everyone. Welcome. Welcome to the Dr. Pat Show. This is Talk Radio to Thrive By. I'm telling you, I got to pinch myself some days because when each of us gets called to do something that we so not thought was in our wheelhouse to do for a purpose that's so much greater than us, we get to show up and shine.
If you would like to show up and shine on the Dr. Pat Show as a co-host or sponsor, send us an email to inspire@thedrpatshow.com.
Choose the new earth on the Cornelia Stephanie Show. Tune in each week on Transformation Talk Radio as Cornelia takes listeners on an odyssey of higher consciousness to inspire, educate, and empower. Cornelia guides people on the path of self-healing, peace, and liberation. The Cornelia Stephanie Show is your catalyst for anchoring heaven on earth on a global scale. For more information, go to CorneliaStephanie.com.
Back on the Knowledge Book Radio with Marge Potasek on Transformation Talk Radio. And I am, of course, Marge Potasek. So again, a reminder, our website is www.usa.theknowledgebook.net. Telephone number for topics and questions is 973-787-7035. Email is mmjp99@gmail.com. Mary, John Peter, 99@gmail.com. And we will continue with our topic for today, which is rocks, art, and evolution. How are these related? So listening, or in me, learning about this topic from a different, completely angle that normally we look at when we look at rocks and how it interplays with us and our evolution. And there is something that was said that rocks are perfect in and of themselves and that they serve. Well, I can understand how the rock can be beautiful and useful, but how can the rock be serving humanity in the true sense of the word? Serving meaning giving something of yourself, being able to give you something that somebody else needs at that particular point in time. And so I started to think and I started to figure out what does the rock have and what is the rock that helps to serve? And what does the rock undergo that allows it to serve? Okay. So when we look at what the rock is, it's categorized by Wikipedia as a rock or stone is a natural substance, a solid aggregate of one or more minerals or mineraloids. For example, granite, a common rock, is a combination of the minerals quartz, feldspar, and biotite. There are three kinds of rocks: igneous rocks, such as basalt, gabbro, granite, obsidian, volcanic ash, and tuff. There are sedimentary rocks, clays, mudstone, shales, limestones, and sandstone. And there are metamorphic rocks, gneiss, marble, quartzite, and schist. Now, if you remember, it was the igneous rocks, like basalt, that were used to carve the softer rocks in previous eras of art development. Sedimentary rocks, if you remember, like the limestones, were the ones, and sandstone were the ones that were used to build the pyramids, that were used to build buildings. And metamorphic rocks, like gneiss and marble, granite were used to decorate. Okay. Now, metamorphic rocks are those that are formed when a previous rock shape, rock form, like igneous or sedimentary rock, gets put under tremendous pressure and heat, so whatever that rock was changes and becomes a much harder and stronger rock. It changes shape, okay? Now, the interesting thing about rocks is that they are composed of minerals. They are composed of things like quartz, like feldspar. They have small particles of mica. They have small particles of molecules. When you look at what the rocks are actually composed of, when we look at feldspar only, the different kinds of feldspar, we see that it's composed of potassium, aluminum, silicon, oxygen. Another form of feldspar called albite is composed of sodium, aluminum, silicon, and oxygen. Another form is composed again of calcium, aluminum, silicon, and oxygen. So all of feldspars are basically silicates of aluminum that contain sodium, potassium, iron, calcium, barium, or a combination of these elements. When you go down and look at the chemical composition of specific rocks, there is something called hornblende. This is a calcium-rich rock, and it's composed of calcium, sodium, magnesium, iron, aluminum, silicon, oxygen, and hydrogen. Okay? So what are these? These are all, when you think about it, and then say, wait a minute, what do you mean calcium? What do you mean sodium? What do you mean magnesium? Hey, that's what I've got in my body. When you look at what the human body is composed of, almost 99% of the mass of the human body is made up of six elements: oxygen, carbon, hydrogen, nitrogen, calcium, and phosphorus. And about 0.85% of our bodies is composed of potassium, sulfur, sodium, chlorine, and magnesium. And let's look at another thing. Not only us, when we look at plants. Plants also have nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium, calcium, magnesium, zinc, sulfur, chlorine, boron, iron, copper, manganese, and molybdenum. Now, all of these elements, all of these chemicals are part of what makes us what we are and makes any animal what they are and plants and everything what it is, okay? So rocks are actually, they're the holders, they're the storehouse of all the elements that exist in nature and that are included in the periodic table. They have various combinations of these elements that have particular functions and properties. So rocks, therefore, are serving as the storehouse of our chemical needs and their combination to compounds that can be utilized by living beings, not only us. How can we say that rocks are serving and evolving? No matter what form a rock takes, whether igneous, sedimentary, or metamorphic, no matter what process it underwent to have a form it currently has, once it achieved that form, then it gives up each of the particles it is composed of to the medium in which it exists, or it is transformed into another type, and the minerals in it are then combined to form different molecules and composite formations that are needed by other forms of life. So the rocks are those that hold all the elements in nature that we need, and they give a particle at a time, whether that giving is done through the mechanism of wind, through the mechanism of rain, through the mechanism of a river flowing by it, through the mechanism of ice, it is giving up of itself, and it produces the soil. And if you've been to the Southwest or seen pictures of the mesas and the buttes, you see the remnants of the mountains that were there previously. And around those mesas and buttes, there are large deposits of soil, sometimes covered by vegetation. Over time, these could become the farmlands that produce the crops we eat. Another example is the Grand Canyon that was produced by the Colorado River. Much of that sedimentary rock that was there before was carved away and then carried away by the Colorado River to another region where that soil was deposited, and now it is farmed to produce the vegetables, fruits, and nuts we consume. Each of the particles given away by the rocks then become part of the soil, then become part of the vegetation, and eventually become a part of the higher and higher forms of animals, and finally to become part of humans. We ourselves cannot eat rocks. We cannot stick a straw into a rock and suck the minerals that we need from that rock. However, because the rock exists, because it is the one that contains all those minerals that we need, then the rock gives of itself, becomes part of some form of vegetation and animal form, and that's when we can have the capacity then to consume this form and are able to continue to live. So at the turn of the century, as I had mentioned before, artists started to depict everyday objects as opposed to the idealized and ideal forms of gods and goddesses and powerful humans who were considered gods and goddesses. The art is starting to present to us a different view of the world around us and had us focus on the mundane as really not being mundane, everyday objects, but as being worthy of appreciation and understanding. It is when we actually start to analyze the little stuff, when we see that the elements in nature in rock are also contained in us, we then research for the way that a particle of rock is now contained in the blood that circulates in our bodies. That's when we start to realize the miracle that surrounds us and allows us to live. when it starts to dawn on us that there is a very long chain of combination and recombination and re-recombination by various forms, starting from the single-celled organisms, like bacteria progressing to many-celled organisms, leading to plant and animal life, that finally provides the form that our bodies can assimilate and continue to live. So the rock serves the definite meaning of service. And now it is time for us to close all the time that we have for this week. So just once again, please visit us at www.usa.theknowledgebook.net. Contact information is mmjp99@gmail.com, marymaryjohnpeter99@gmail.com, or 973-787-7035. Please do send topics and questions. We're looking forward to getting them and appreciate receiving them. So all the best. Please take care. And until we see you next time, this has been Marge Potasik on Knowledge Book Radio with Marge Potasik. Take care.
You've been listening to Knowledge Book Radio with Marge Potasik. Marge was led to the Knowledge Book, a gift to humanity, and its time of transition to the Golden Age that provided the truth and energies and frequencies. Now, she shares information from and answers questions about the Knowledge Book with you each Tuesday at 1 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. Eastern on TransformationTalkRadio.com. For more information, visit Marge at usa.theknowledgebook.net.